Hello, it's Monday, July the 5th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Now, coming up, we're going to be talking about that extraordinary football match on Saturday. And what's even more extraordinary, I actually watched a bit of it. Also, Mouchy ice cream. It is the new big food sensation. We'll tell you all about it. Cladding, if you're one of those people stuck in a block of flats with Grenfell-style cladding, not much hope in sight for any solution to that anytime soon. William and Harry, while the rift between the two brothers shows absolutely no sign of abating. But first, they're calling it Freedom Day. It's 2 weeks away. The Prime Minister finally lifting social distancing. But will you choose to still wear a mask? So, Boris Johnson, at a Downing Street press conference, there'll be a similar statement in the House of Commons, is going to declare the long-awaited end to most lockdown restrictions on July 19th. It's inevitably been dubbed Freedom Day. Social distancing rules, the work-from-home order and mask mandates are to be ditched, and Britons will be advised to learn to live with the virus, just as we do with flu. Dr. Barrett Pancana is a senior clinical lecturer at the University of Exeter and joins me now to talk about it. Dr. Pancana, we've talked about this from time to time. We now see light, if you can forgive the cliche, at the end of what has been a very, very, very long lockdown tunnel. Is the government getting it right, in your view? We can now get rid of most of these rules?
We have to be cautious because a substantial percentage of our population is not yet fully immunised. And the second bit is we don't know what the future brings. And therefore, the messaging has to be very precise and very measured rather than populist. So the messaging has to be, for the time being, some restrictions can be removed, but they may have to be reintroduced. And people who are vulnerable and may not make good immunity after immunization, etc., ought to still continue with wearing face masks. And we also need to have better attention to poorly ventilated indoor places.
The face mask is going to be one of the big debating points, Dr. Pancana. As you know, there was initially, when we went into this pandemic, the World Health Organization advised we didn't need to wear face masks. Then they changed their mind back in, I think, July last year. It's going to become, we form our own view. If we want to wear a face mask on public transport, that's fine. Or if we wear it into a shop. Do you think there should be a clear rule from the government there on face masks? For instance, should you have to wear one?
It's very important that this messaging and the clear rules are there, because to leave it as I leave it to your personal discretion is not good enough. And with respect to science, is you learn. And as you learn, you change your mind and you take a new direction. So initially, with regard to SARS-CoV-2, the impression was that it's droplet spread and it's through contaminated hands. But now it is very clear, it's clear to anybody who wishes to know, that there is a huge element of aerosol spread. Now that we know what we know, we also got to act according to what we know, which is the masks will save your life.
You think that they're that important, do you?
I do.
That's interesting. People listening to this will be very interested in what you've got to say, Dr. Pancana. So what is your message to people listening about masks even after July the 19th?
So it's very important, especially in at-risk areas. So at-risk areas would be closed indoor spaces, poorly ventilated indoor places, crowded buses, tubes and trains, that sort of thing, where there's a lot of human beings. And it is particularly important for people who are not immunized, number one. And number two, people who are immunized but may not make good immunity. So if you have got suboptimal immune system, you are vulnerable to infections because of other underlying health conditions, then it is in your interest to be properly protected with a good quality, a higher quality mask worn properly.
I'm not sure if you're up to speed on this, Doctor, but Bloomberg are reporting that in Israel, where restrictions have been lifted, they're a couple of weeks ahead of us, there's been a huge surge in the number of infections. There has not been a surge in the number of deaths or the number of hospitalizations. We are going to almost certainly, aren't we, when these restrictions are lifted, particularly if people start going back to work, back into offices, we're going to see a large spike in the number of infections, but we shouldn't panic.
Of course we shouldn't, but we need to prevent, and prevention is better than the cure. And my reasons for urging prevention and protection are, so even Israel, for example, has introduced wearing of masks in indoor crowded, poorly ventilated places. They are acting according to the science. Now, you see, there is a big element of long COVID, and long COVID is very scary in that we don't know a lot about it, but if it leaves a lot of people with memory loss, fatigue, shortness of breath, kidney problems, heart problems, etc., then we have a problem. And we must try and avoid this problem, because these problems cost money, cost your well-being. And one way to stop all that is to be precautionary and wear masks. For example, try not to get infected.
So you're going to carry on wearing a mask. Would you, if you go into a shop, doctor, will you wear a mask?
So, well, I'll give you my clear understanding of how I will perform going forward, which is if I get the feeling I'm on a crowded tube train, I definitely will. If I get the feeling I've walked into a large supermarket and it's not crowded and it's not busy and I can sense that it is properly ventilated, I may decide, if the case numbers in that part of the country are low, that my risk is low. So watchfulness of what's going on in the community, what are the case numbers doing, and what is that premises looking like, is the better way forward. And I've always done that. I've always advised that is, you know, take your soundings, you know, look, watch, see, and then decide. And that is a good way to do, because we can't prescribe all measures all the time to everyone. But everyone can make their own assessments. And if they feel unsafe in any place, do their own mitigation.
Very interesting advice indeed. That's Dr. Bharat Pankhania. He's a senior clinical lecturer at the University of Exeter. Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.
So why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. ITV's prime-time documentary, Harry and William, What Went Wrong, was broadcast last night, but with a major cut, which was made at the 11th hour. Statements regarding Prince William having allegedly briefed newspapers regarding his brother's mental health were removed from the documentary. I'm joined now by the Daily Mail's Royal Editor, Rebecca English, who is all over this story. Rebecca, astonishing timing, this programme, in the first place. We saw William and Harry together, united, unveiling the statue to their mother. Enough said about the statue. I think it's ghastly, by the way. But then just 3 or 4 days later, bang, another hostile briefing about William from Harry's side.
Yes, I know. And I think this is something the palace really wish would die a death, but it's not going to anytime soon, because, of course, people are fascinated about this situation and the stories behind it.
And Omid Scobie, who wrote the biography of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, he, if the programme hadn't been cut, what was he going to say, Rebecca, that caused such angst at Kensington Palace?
Well, yeah, the reason why this came out is an advanced copy of the programme was given to the Mail on Sunday. And in it, there was an excerpt showing an interview with Omid Scobie, as you rightly say, is the Sussex's biographer, who's become, I mean, some people feel, a bit of a cheerleader for them. And in it, he said that in the aftermath of the Tom Bradby documentary, which caused such a stink in 2019, I don't know if you remember it, it's when Meghan famously said no one had ever asked her if she was okay. And in the aftermath of that, and there's a very, very specific phrase that has got people's hackles up. He said that palace aides, possibly on the orders of Prince William, briefly had concerns about Harry's mental health after the documentary was aired. And that is what's upset people so much, because, of course, Prince William, as well as Kate and Prince Harry, have been dedicated campaigners on the issue of mental health for many, many years now. And it's something that William takes incredibly seriously.
And there was no evidence, I gather, to support the claim anyway.
None. I mean, it's not been denied that, Palisade did say that William watched the documentary with genuine concern for his brother. I mean, Harry and Meghan both stood there and said, look, we're not happy. And I think the feeling is that anyone would be concerned about a family member if you were watching that. But that's very, very different from briefing. You had concerns about your brother's mental health. And that was definitely something the palace felt they needed to push back on.
It doesn't feel like this rift between the two brothers is going to end anytime soon, Rebecca.
It's not, I'm afraid, unless there's a kind of drastic change in circumstances. And it is sad, but I suppose there is a feeling that sometimes things like this do happen in families. Unfortunately for them, it's being played out on a really, really grand scale. But I think a lot of water has gone under the bridge over the last year. Things have been said, largely on, sadly, from Harry's side, that have really upset family members. And there's going to have to be, I say an enormous rapprochement. I don't know what will change things. Maybe time, who knows?
Maybe. Just finally, Rebecca, it's been reported, I know you're in the thick of that story, that Kate Middleton, the Duchess of Cambridge, she's cancelled engagements as she's self-isolating. Is she self-isolating for 10 days? Do we know how long?
Yeah, it is 10 days. So basically, we found out this morning from Kensington Palace that she got told, she wasn't pinged by the app, so she clearly got told personally on Friday afternoon that someone she'd been in close contact with had subsequently tested positive for COVID. She's now self-isolating for 10 days, which means she's had to pull out of a number of engagements today to mark the NHS anniversary, which obviously she's very disappointed about. Prince William can still do that because under regulations, he doesn't need to self-isolate unless she's showing symptoms, which she's not. But it is, you know, it's a real shame for them. It's a real shame for the people that we're going to meet them today.
Just shows COVID is unforgiving. It doesn't matter whether you're prince or pauper, it can get people.
Absolutely. Of course, the Prince of Wales and Prince William himself both had it last year in varying kind of degrees. Prince William quite badly by all accounts. So, and it just shows that, you know, it does still pay to be a bit cautious.
Absolutely. That's the Daily Mail's Royal Editor, Rebecca English. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, and much, much more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryboyPierce. So in the wake of the shocking Grenfell fire disaster, leaseholders have been facing enormous repair bills to remove similar dangerous cladding. New rules now announced by the Housing Secretary, Robert Jenrick, are offering homeowners more time to sue, but critics say they'll only benefit lawyers looking for get-rich-quick schemes. Liam Spender is from the End Our Cladding Scandal campaign, and he joins me now to explain why these new rules aren't as good as they may sound. Liam, if I can use your first name, what Robert Jenrick says is the period during which developers can face legal action over shoddy workmanship has been lengthened from 6 to 15 years. But I don't think that's the problem your campaign is facing. The problem I think your campaign is facing is leaseholders simply can't afford the huge bills to remove the cladding, which they didn't put there in the first place.
Absolutely, yes. And many of them have been wiped out by costs for waiting watch and increased insurance. So to ask them to finance litigation, which is what the government's doing with these changes, just isn't practical at all. It's not going to deliver what we need, as you say, which is money to make these repairs and get this cladding off.
Some leaseholders, I think, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, are facing repair bills of up to £150,000, which is a huge amount of money.
Absolutely. I mean, the government's indicating that the sector's been too risk averse, and that's why we're seeing these crazy numbers. I mean, it's almost the value of a house in some parts of the UK.
It is.
But they don't seem to be doing anything to stop it. It's just another slap on the wrist rather than actual effective action.
And the idea now that you can legal action will go from 6 to 15 years, I imagine the lawyers are jumping up and down, rubbing their hands with glee.
Well, I mean, I am a litigation lawyer by trade, but
you're going to do all right then.
It's if only. I mean, I don't think it's. I mean, it's a start, and for some buildings, it could be very useful because if they have a viable claim against someone with the money to pay, it may help them achieve a settlement. But for most people, getting involved in a multi-year dispute with a well-resourced, heavily lawyered up builder isn't going to solve anything in the near term.
How many leaseholders do you estimate are still in this invidious position where they're living in a block of flats with potentially lethal cladding and where they've got no resolution with the landlord or the builder? How many are in that position?
I think we're looking at tens of thousands, even on the government's own numbers. There's something just shy of 90,000 buildings that the government thinks needs remediating. So even if there's only a few hundred people in each building, you're looking at millions of leaseholders who are affected in some way, shape or form by this issue.
And the government's created a £5 billion fund to help, but I think that conservative estimate, that's probably £10 billion short.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, at least. I mean, you see some numbers floating around at maybe 50 or 100 billion. I think the issue is because no one's actually gone out and surveyed these buildings and worked out which have problems and how much it's going to cost. There's no certain figure. It's all scrabbling around, clutching at straws at the moment.
This could become quite a hot potato politically because 90,000 potential voters, 90,000 families, that's quite a lot of votes, particularly if it's in a marginal constituency. And if the government sticks its head in the sand like it is at the moment with sticking up £5 billion, potentially this could cause a lot of difficulties for this Conservative government.
And I think that's part of the thinking behind offering this extension to time limits for bringing claims. I think they see it as a no-cost way of buying off jittery Conservative backbenchers because they can point to this concession as helping leaseholders. But I think you're quite right. I think what will cause the government an increasingly large political headache is the fact that all the people living in these buildings, young or old, they have relatives, some of whom will live in Conservative seats. So even if this is a problem with buildings concentrated in the inner cities, eventually it's going to touch the famous Shire Tories.
Yeah, and I talked to one Tory MP. I could not repeat on this podcast the language he used to describe the government's response to the leasehold problem. And he said, he thinks it's going to cost him his seat.
Well, I mean, perhaps that proves the point I've just made. I think time will tell. But if I were a Conservative backbencher, I'd be very, very worried about how this problem is growing all the time.
Absolutely. That's Liam Spender. He is from the End Our Cladding Scandal campaign. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, he's got a lot on his plate because it's all happening on the Sport Watch this week. But Matt Gatwood, who is, of course, the Daily Mail's deputy sports editor, here with the latest sports news. Well, it was pointed out on television this morning, Matt, that history has been made with the England match because it was the first time Andrew Pearce has watched a football match for 20 years. And I said, wrong, probably for 30 years, actually.
Excellent. Did you enjoy it?
I did. I can confess how I watched it. I was watching it with a girlfriend and the TV was on with the volume down. So we were chatting. I hadn't seen her for a long time because of lockdown. And we kept looking up and every time there was a goal, we turned it on, we turned up the volume and we watched the action replay and it was exciting.
Good.
Really pleased.
A convert.
They played well?
They played very well. It was an amazing performance. Yeah. I mean, we always thought that Ukraine weren't going to offer as much up, obviously, as Germany. Mm. But still, you know, at any stage when you're in a quarterfinal of a championship like this, it's just almost unheard of that you would, you know, smash a team so comprehensively. Mm. Obviously, they were helped by the early goal.
Yeah.
But they played brilliantly. You know, it couldn't have been a more perfect evening for England. Getting the early goal, Kane scoring again. Yeah. So he now feels like he's coming into form at just the perfect time.
Yeah.
And then to score again so soon after half time, which really put the game to bed. Mm. And there were all these other things, like we scored from a set piece, which we, you know, sort of hadn't done as like we had at the previous World Cup. And Southgate's always adamant that's a very important part of your game to get right because so many goals come from set pieces. So then we score from two set pieces. Kane gets another goal to sort of further improve his confidence. Jordan Henderson comes on and scores. We're able to rest players who are on yellow cards so that everybody is available now for the semi-final. So it really was.
And what happened to Mr. Grealish, who was the star turn in when he came on as a substitute? Did he play at all?
No, he didn't come on. So, I mean, this is
didn't
just...
Need
it. It didn't need him. And this is the sort of, you know, he played Sancho, who had his first, Jadon Sancho, the new Man United signing, who just moved to Man U for 70 right. million. Well, he started his first game of the Euros because Saka was injured. So he's got this embarrassment of riches in that one position. So now the decision for the Denmark semi-final on Wednesday night is who he plays, who he brings in. Now, we think probably they're going to be four. They'll keep the same shape of four defenders at the back.
Yeah.
But the only real selection dilemma, therefore, you would think, is who whether Saka comes back in for Sancho or whether Phil Foden starts.
Right.
And you think Phil Foden started the first two games, got booked in one of those games, so they rested him for the third game, so he didn't get a ban. He hasn't been seen since. So, you know, it's a good position for Southgate to be in, that he's got your likes of Grealish, yeah, Saka, Sancho, Foden, who can all play in that one position.
Very good. And we'll talk again on the day, because Wednesday is the big match, and of course they're going to have that huge advantage of playing in front of a home crowd in Wembley.
They will. I mean, that can't be underestimated. Denmark have played a lot of their games at home, so they've been sort of backed by their own fans up to this point.
Yeah.
And now suddenly they're going to be, you know, 50,000 England fans in the stadium and only 5,000 Danish fans. So that's going to be a big factor.
Yeah.
I do think this Danish team much stronger than the Ukraine side.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, we've talked about the Eriksen factor as well. So it's not going to be, I don't see this one being a 4-0 win.
No.
I think this one could be a slightly more nail-biting affair.
Well, that'd be back to England's usual,
yeah,
won't it?
Yeah, I know.
Well, we'll talk about that on Wednesday. But also, Matt, tennis. So Cameron Norrie got knocked out to Roger Federer. I'm sorry, but I'm thrilled, because as you know, I'm in love with Roger Federer.
Of course.
He is a god.
Of course.
But the great all hopes now on English shoulders of Emma Raducanu, only 18, number 338 in the world, and she's in the last 16.
Yeah, incredible performance so far.
Yeah.
So you're right. Yeah, the men, we had three men into the last 16 for the first time since 1999.
Great.
They all lost on Friday, leaving just Emma Raducanu to fly the flag. She won on Saturday, and now plays again today on Monday. So she has been a breath of fresh air.
I've never even heard of her.
Well, to be fair, not many. You know, unless you're an absolute tennis aficionado. Not many people would have done, because of the lack of game time, because of the COVID situation, meaning that she hasn't been around the world playing as many of these events. You know, real aficionados would say, well, this one's the one that's been talked about a lot, you know, in the in British tennis circles. She's the up-and-coming thing. But we haven't seen much of her. Here she comes, 18, like a breath of fresh air, smile on her face.
Yeah, she's lovely.
Brilliant player, and looks remarkable. And I wouldn't be surprised if she wins today, and goes on even further into the quarters. So fair play to her, and it's brilliant to see her, and it's brilliant to see her doing it with a smile.
And it's amazing, isn't it, Matt? It just shows how young she is. She's waiting on her A-level results.
She's waiting for A-level results. Isn't
that
remarkable?
Put it in perspective. I know when I was waiting for my A-level results, I just started work on the Gloucestershire Echo Cheltenham. Not quite the same as appearing in front of tens of thousands of people at Wimbledon.
Indeed, not quite the same. So she's taking it all remarkably well and in her stride at the moment. So fingers crossed she can go, you know, one better or even further.
Yeah.
Because the other thing about the women's draw is that it's so wide open.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these players in the women's draw have never been to this stage of the tournament before. Because women's tennis is in this sort of slightly unusual place where there isn't kind of, you know, two or three dominant players. Serena's obviously on the way down.
Yeah.
Ash Barty, who's still in it, she's never been this far in Wimbledon. So it's really kind of wide open. Now, I'm not suggesting by any stretch that Raducanu can go on and win it, but, you know, she could certainly go win today. She could even, who knows?
I'm old enough to remember Boris Becker winning Wimbledon, unseeded, age 17 or 18.
Yes, exactly, yes. So,
and then the following year, he was knocked out in the first round.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But that was back in 85 or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, we could be on for a Raducanu England double, couldn't we, at the weekend? Who knows?
That'd be great. That's great. That's Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood, who'll be back with us again on the day of the next big match. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MelPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. So with some proper summer weather finally making an appearance today, there's a new ice cream trend in Britain, and it's called Mouchy ice cream. No, I'd never heard of it either. It's Japanese. It comes in flavours including eat and mess, and it's a fraction of the calories. Here to explain it all is our intrepid food writer, Sudhi Pigott. Sudhi, you've tried it. What's it like?
It's really delicious, and it's quite different. It's, as in lots of Asian food, it's all about the texture. So mochi are covered in a very kind of chewy wrapping, which is made out of a glutinous rice dough. So it's not like bubblegum, because that's not a very pleasant comparison, but it has some of that chewiness to it, but it's very easy to eat, easy to digest. Doesn't really taste of anything, but is actually quite pleasing. And you keep them in the freezer, and you have to allow them maybe 5 minutes to thaw a little bit. So you have all the anticipation, and people have been going mad on TikTok with doing a countdown to when they're ready to eat. And then when you bite into them, you have the ice cream and this slightly kind of squidgy, chewy exterior. So, yeah, it's quite curious, but very pleasing.
They're a brother and sister, Vivian and Howard Wong. They started this brand from their London home kitchen 10 years ago, and they're claiming we get through two of their mouchy balls every second in the UK. They've become so popular.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
Sales up more than 2,000% during the first half of this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's every food entrepreneur's dream come true. And they were working in a kind of banking world before, and actually their parents had a more traditional Asian baking business, which did include mochi and all sorts of other Japanese dessert-like confections. But they just saw an opportunity to focus on the ice cream ones and create a new kind of snack. And Vivian says it's just like this tiny moment of a treat, like a treat in terms of a little snack. And so that's what they think is the appeal, that it's very tactile. And it's just a little thing, but it has quite a lot of impact, and the taste lingers in your mouth. So you don't feel hard done by if you just have one mochi rather than a huge ice cream sundae, and that's part of the appeal for me.
Yeah, and they're flying off the shelves. You can get them in Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Ocado, Asda, and they're not that expensive because there's you can get them. I think it's Lidl, isn't it? Lidl are doing their own version, £2.99
for six. Lidl and Aldi, if you can actually find them, because every time I've been, they've been sold out.
Have they really? And the popularity is down to them being promoted on TikTok, I gather.
It is. That's where it all started. One of their new recruits, one of their new marketing recruits, said, oh, during lockdown, can I play with this on TikTok? And that's how it all started. And then they, because it got taken up so much, they created a proper campaign and little animated mochi as well. And it's just gone crazy with people putting up their own videos of them going to big Tesco's in search of mochi and all their adventures in trying to track them down and queuing up outside first thing in the morning for new deliveries, and silly levels of excitement.
Well, I mean, I'm going to have to catch on with this because I'm a bit behind. I see some that the new quirkily British limited edition flavours they're launching today. I've mentioned Eat and Mess already. Candy floss and even fish and chips. That sounds disgusting.
Yeah, I like the sound of it because I have a fondness for vinegar, so I actually like the idea. I think it's going to be more of the vinegar and not too much fishiness, but I haven't managed to get my hands on some yet, but I'm sure I'm going to. They're actually taking their own version of an ice cream van on tour, starting in London and going all over Hastings, Bournemouth, Eastbourne, and so on. And so those flavours will only be available on that or in like a big pack, variety pack you can buy online.
Sounds great. And it's good to hear that somebody's doing very well in the pandemic.
Yeah, and there's some smaller companies as well. There's one called Anon Mouchy, which has been started up by two marketeers, but they specialise in mouchy with ganache and cheesecake fillings, and I really like them. I thought they were a more interesting alternative to a macaron, and they come really exquisitely packaged.
It sounds absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, and of course the Japan Centre is very good as well.
They would be. It all sounds good, apart from the fish and chips mouchy. I'm definitely going to give that a miss. But Sudhi, you've written a fabulous piece about it. That's Sudhi Piggott, food writer, talking about the new sensation of the summer pandemic, mouchy ice cream. Great to talk to you, Sudhi, as ever. Take care now.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, why don't you download the Mail Plus app? Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.